1 Samuel chapter 3. Now the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. And it came to pass at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, and when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down, that the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, "Here am I." So he ran to Eli and said, "Here am I, for you called me." And he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." And he went and lay down. Then the Lord called yet again, "Samuel." So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, "Here am I, for you called me." He answered, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. And the Lord called Samuel again the third time. So he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you did call me." Then Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood and called as at other time, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel answered, "Speak, for your servant hears." And the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. And therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." So Samuel lay down until morning and opened the doors of the house of the Lord. And Samuel was afraid to tell Eli the vision. Then Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." He answered, "Here am I." And he said, "What is the word that the Lord spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. God do so to you, and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the things that he said to you." Then Samuel told him everything, and he hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." So Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel had been established as a prophet of the Lord. Then the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Dave, for reading 1 Samuel chapter 3. Before we go into this, it's a relatively short chapter, only, 21 verses or so. Pretty simple, seems straightforward, though it's not. Before we begin my little spiel of any comments or questions, that caught your attention and said, that's an interesting thing that occurred, or maybe why something occurred. Because I may not get to them if you don't ask, because I may have my own list of things I intended to cover. It may not cover yours. Any comments or questions at all? Yes, Anne.
Eli was the priest.
Yes, he was a high priest at the time.
And the child was hearing God call him. Yet Eli didn't seem to be interested in knowing what God had to say to the child, you know. I mean, it's like...
Well, he asked him...
He asked him,
in the following morning, Eli asked, "Okay, what did God talk to you? What did he say?
Well, in the beginning it says the word of the Lord was precious, and there was no open vision. So
right.
If the child was getting an open vision of the Lord, you would think, you know, he's the man of God, Eli is the man of appointed.
I think it might be because I don't think Eli realized at first that God was talking to Samuel.
This was the middle of the night.
Exactly. Think of what was going on. What was going on at the time? It's nighttime. He doesn't necessarily know.
It's like 2-3 a.m. in the morning. Somebody wakes you up. Are you coherent enough? He's like, go to bed, kiddo. Go back.
Yeah, you're hearing things. Admittedly, it points out that it wasn't very common. The word of the Lord wasn't common at that time, so it may not have been very. Well, may not have been. Eli had been talking to God in the years past, but it may not have been in Eli's wherewithal, at least, to realize that he was talking to, or Samuel was talking to God at the time.
So
not super
Isaac
certain.
Isaac wakes you up at 2 a.m. some day, saying.
Actually, he does. I let him cry himself to sleep because he usually cries up about, you know, actually it's close to about 3.
God is talking to me.
Yes, Hector.
Are you going to expound verse by verse this thing, or can I say something? Just
you can jump. If something jumps in, go ahead and say what you're saying.
I mean, the thing that just pops out at me, you know, is that scary thing.
Which one is
and
that?
Therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever.
Right.
And nothing that these guys will do.
It will never undo it.
It's like, you know, it just reminds me of what the Lord said. You know, it's like every sin, you know, can be forgiven, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except for the blasphemy.
Certain ones he can't.
Against blasphemy of the Spirit. Is that what happened here?
Well, yes, in many ways. Multiple ways, actually, I should say. In the fact, the previous chapters, we had ran across Eli and his sons, and what his sons were doing to, obviously, the various women who were at the temple, to the sacrifices that were offered. They were harvesting things out of sequence, out of order, taking their own portion bigger or greater than that of anyone else's. All things that God said, you will not do. And acting as high priest and the priesthood makes all the Israel starting to blaspheme God. Look what they do. Look what the priests do. Look what they're doing to this. This is disgraceful. Well, God doesn't take kindly upon you making scenarios such that people curse him because of your actions. Certain things he doesn't allow. You look at Aaron's two sons. What was the first son said? All right, they brought a foreign fire. We don't know all the details regarding it. It doesn't say, okay, all the, you know, the background of the story. But either way, it was unacceptable. It was pulling people away from attention to God and attention to these two individuals, which is exactly what Eli and his sons were doing at this point in time, essentially taking over or corrupting the house of God. That's not something he takes kind to. And he points out, it will never be undone. And it never was, at least while the few records we have of their descendants, it was never undone. They all died very young. With the exception of one notable distinction, he lived to 60-something, but that was because he was a very kind, gentle man and worked his whole life to try to rectify it by being generous and kind and godly to other people. He was the exception. All of his descendants and everybody prior to him died very young, in their 40s or 30s. Is a curse to God held true? Now, we don't know who the currently modern-day descendants of Eli and his children are. I have no idea. It doesn't really matter. The point is, the records that they do have, God's word held true. It's not something to mess with. You don't play with God's house. Yes, David.
Every time I come across that passage and that point where he actually kind of bullies and manipulates Samuel to speak and actually only pronounces a curse over
curse
him.
Curse upon him, right.
To get him to, you know, say what God spoke to him. I'm like, gee, that's not too godly.
No, it's not. But I think there's one thing that's very important about it. You know that Eli didn't say... Or Eli says, may all these things that you heard come upon you if you don't tell me.
Oh.
Eli knew it was not a positive thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He knew ahead of time. This was a very negative. Whatever Samuel heard was going to be negative upon him and upon his family. He wanted to know, if you don't tell me everything, may it all happen on you. Because he knew it was bad. He seemed to know exactly what it was. He has Hannah first.
I was just saying it's a common thing about similar to the I adjure you in the name of the Most High God to proclaim. You see that down through time. You see that in the trial of Yeshua as well. That kind of a high priestly
action or
call
return.
To witness, basically.
To be truthful.
That you cannot pass on it.
Hold on, Susan, hand up.
I'm just, as I was reading this, as Dave was reading it, it just, what
stood out to me was the similarity between this situation and today, that the word of the Lord, there's been very few visions. We are so, our society is so far removed. And here you have a family with whom he's even the high priest, and yet his own children are living lifestyles worthy of God's curse.
Right.
And yet he had failed to rebuke his sons. And this just because of probably because what I've just been through with Zoe and all of the flack that I got for calling her on it, and what it costs. It costs you when you rebuke your kid. But the fact is, that is true love. If you, if your children are doing something against the Most High God and you keep quiet because that's what's done at the time, then you are allowing God's curse eventually to fall on them. Mm-hmm. So it behooves us then to make a stand, even though you're unpopular and people are telling you to shut up and butt out. You've got to do it.
That's very true. It's true. It's very true. Yes, Ellie, you had your hand up.
When you're dealing with a child that has something that he knows is bad, and this isn't a little bitty kid, but he's a young boy.
Relatively young.
The way that you're going to say, I want to know every word of it.
Is a threat.
That's a threat. So that he is more afraid to not tell you than he is to tell. Because
Samuel was afraid. He was afraid to tell him. Had Eli said nothing, do you think Samuel would have said, oh, hey, Eli, guess what happened? Not likely.
Or he would have just told him, he talked to me.
Yeah, no. and not discuss all details.
You tell me every word or you're in trouble.
We don't know the exact age of Samuel. You're right. It's been debated his age. Reality is most likely he's under the age of 20. That's pretty much all we know about this point. We don't know how young the kid could be 10. We don't know yet. Yes.
I was just thinking that, you know, there's a scripture that says all things work to the good of those who love him. And even if this was, you know, a threatening, manipulative situation for him, it still obviously worked good for the rest of his life.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think it was Ezekiel that was told, you know, the blood will be on your hands if you do not warn the people.
Right, right. The person who's the watchman.
And
yeah.
For Samuel, I mean, there were things that he said to Saul and to other kings that were things
this
that
is a
you
very,
do not want to tell people
right.
in power.
Yes, yes. The ones who have the sword in their hand is not a wise person to get upset with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked. You know, I mean, this statement probably stayed with him, you know, for good.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it was a learning scenario for Samuel himself. And that she's right in that because he's young, because he leaves a very important impression, and as he got older throughout his later years, he didn't show fear of anyone. To some extent, I mean, he had to, you know, sneak around in order to get a job done, but it wasn't necessarily, that was in order to get the job completed, in order to God's task completed. But he still spoke very openly to everybody. He told me the absolute truth. Hey, this is how it is. Take it or leave it. He didn't show fear, he trusted God. And that's a very important thing for any prophet to have. It's an important trait, if I can use that term. It's an important thing to learn, and he learned it. He learned it very quickly at this point in time in his life. Again, we don't know how old he is. Some argue, some Jewish tradition, oh, he had to be at least 40 years old to service in the temple. Garbage. That's just garbage. He it says he's a lad, and just as it did with David, most likely he was under the age of 20, thereabouts, or very close to the age of 20. Once you're 20 years old in biblical Judaism, you are a grown man, you're responsible for anything, everything you do. Everything that has ever happened to you from that point forward is between you and God, it's on your head. Your parents are absolved from anything you've ever done. Prior to that, if you're living with your parents, you have a certain amount of transition time, which you are partially responsible, but your parents are still helped to guide you throughout your life. So he's still under Eli's tutelage. He is not his own, quote, priest, in a quote, if I use that term. Thus, he's most likely under the age of 20. Now, let's see, should I jump ahead on that? Oh, yes, Richard.
One thing that said that the people didn't realize he was a prophet.
Right.
They didn't say priest.
No, prophet.
Jeremiah was a prophet as a child.
Right.
So God does use
prophets,
but not necessarily serve the temple yet.
Not usually, no.
Not yet to be there.
Eli, I think, was the only one that was a prophet and priest, like actually high priest, a combo mix. Everybody else was a prophet or a priest. And I don't, when
Ezekiel
I said,
was.
Oh, was he, I think he was a high priest, though.
He was a high, I think he was a high priest. He was a high priest.
I don't think he was high. I could be wrong. I don't think he was high priest. I was wrong. Anyway. Anyway, the point is that Samuel wasn't in the high priestly line. He wasn't a descendant of the high priestly line. He was a Levitical priest, not a high priest. So he couldn't perform the inner sanctuary duties. He could still, however, do all various sacrificial requirements and everything else on the sun he had to learn. He could still do all those because it was completely acceptable. Just because he wasn't a high priest doesn't mean he couldn't do all the priestly functions. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, okay, we'll just go ahead and dive into this, if that's okay with the rest of you. Verse 2.
Where?
Verse 2. In that day, it says, it happened on that day, Uzzah was lying in his place, and his eyes had become so dim he could not see, We'll stop there for a minute. Verse 2. In that day, what day is that? Not that I'm expecting any of you to remember this, but think back a couple of weeks. When I discussed with chapter 2, tradition states this is the same day that the prophet had come to Eli and declared, this is what's happening to you and your sons. Okay. It was that following night that God spoke to Samuel, that following evening, that night time or when the dark said. Chapter 2, in case those of you had forgotten, this is the discussion which, behold, days are coming when I shall cut off your arm. This is verse 31 of chapter 2. And the arm of your father's family from here to being an old person. Family. So this is the prophet that had talked to Eli and declared, hey, you, your son, your descendants are all going to be dead at young men, as young age. Well, that following evening, hence is probably one of the reasons why Eli realized this is going to be a negative prophecy when Samuel and talked to God. Samuel speaks to God and says, this was going to happen, Samuel, and gives a little more detail. Not a lot of detail, just a little more confirmation. We all use the term of multiple witnesses, right? We're familiar with that concept. Well, this is no different. How does Eli know the prophet that talked to him was telling him the truth?
Second
witness. Well, God says, okay, here, I'll prove it. Second witness says it'll happen again. Now, the prophet gave him a witness as well. Said, when your children die on the same day, that's the witness that guarantees this will happen. But that's still yet to occur. God speaking to Samuel verified, yeah, this really is going to occur, Eli.
Well, he also had the own witness in his heart because he knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing was wrong. He knew it was an unacceptable behavior. Yeah, he talked to his sons, please. He had the authority as high priest to literally kick them out of the temple, if not arrest them or have them charged. He didn't. He chose not to. So he had his own serious fault. So it's believed, common belief, that it was the same or that following evening. Verse 3 is where I'll focus on verse 3. I'll come back to it again later. But it starts out, says, the lamp of God had not yet gone out. Now, lamp of God. What is that? Say it again.
The word.
The word? We're doing a physical lamp.
Is it the light in the temple?
The temple. And what's the light made of? What is it?
Menorah.
The menorah. Well, which you can't see behind here. It's a menorah lamp. The tabernacle. It's a menorah. So we don't know what its size was. I know they rebuilt it later on and made this really big, huge, massive monstrosity, but I don't know what size it was originally. The very original one that God, well,
gives instructions. Well, right, but 5 foot by 3 foot.
Right, but they rebuilt it back when the king showed up. So they rebuilt it again, made it bigger. But I don't, or bigger, different, I should say, not bigger, just different. So we don't know the exact dimensions, but we know what it looked like, meaning its shape. The lamp of God had not yet burned out. What's that mean?
Isn't it supposed to be lit all the time?
It's supposed to be lit all night. Uh-huh. All night it's supposed to always stay on. But not all day, just all night. Mm-hmm. Now, does anybody remember or recall the rules for the lamp of God and its lighting and how everything works with this lamp?
Was that the priest's responsibility to keep it lit?
Exactly. Priests keep it lit.
Especially the high priest.
But he can allow other priests to light it for him. But yes,
he's responsible.
If something is not lit, he is the one who's held responsible for it, for going out prematurely.
The servant lamp is the center one, and all the others are lit off of it.
Mm-hmm.
and the priest's old garments were used, twisted, and used.
Well,
that's
second temple.
The second temple was the old garment. We don't know about the first one. We don't know. We just don't know. We don't know. But you're right. You're right. So every evening at the evening sacrifice, the lamp is lit. It must maintain its light, maintain being lit, all the way through until the morning. Morning sacrifice begins. You take put the lamp out. That's how it works. It must be lit all night long. We'll get into what the lamps mean in a minute. I'm hoping to get there. I should have enough time. But anyway, it's important to note the lamp is currently on. It's active, meaning it's still in the middle of the night. We know that. Most likely it's within eyesight or near Samuel, because there's a reason he didn't just say, oh, in the night. He said before the lamp of God had burned out. There's a reason Samuel includes that in this statement. Yes?
When he was sleeping in the sanctuary.
He's not allowed to sleep in the sanctuary. He's allowed to sleep. There are rules regarding in the sanctuary where the lamp is actually at. No man is allowed to lay down inside that. God declared you will die. He will kill you. See, he's allowed to lay next to it, but not actually physically in it. That's where the Holy of Holies is right there. You don't get to go inside. Unfortunately, in English, it's a very, very poor wording. Unfortunately. The phrase, the way it's actually specified, is that the lamp of God had not gone out yet in the temple of the Lord where the ark was, and Samuel was lying near. Not lying in the temple of the Lord where the ark was. He would be dead if he lay next to the ark. You can't do that. There are rules regarding certain things. And besides not touching it, various things he can't do. But he may have been responsible for making sure the lamp didn't go out. He's got to stay nearby, because anybody can monitor it throughout the night, just as long as it stays lit. He can stay nearby and watch it, or sleep near it.
And his two sons are killed.
They soon die. They're not dead yet, but they soon will die. He wasn't physically inside, but he was at least within a quick distance of the lamp itself. So it hadn't gone on yet. Part of Samuel's most likely responsibility. So it was important to note that. We'll come back to it shortly, because it actually becomes very important as to what God's doing in this one chapter, is because his lamp had not gone out yet. Let's see, Samuel's... Okay, I'll come back to verse 3 in a minute. A few minutes, actually. Verse 4 through verse 5, we read this. Okay, so God starts talking to Samuel. When Eli was training Samuel, what was he training Samuel for?
Priesthood,
wasn't it? To do priestly functions, right? He's serving the Lord, serving the God. Was Eli training Samuel to be a prophet?
No,
he was not. Now, can you hire, at this point in time in history, can you hire someone to train your son to be a prophet?
Yes,
that's perfectly acceptable, and wealthy families usually did so. We have Isaiah as one of the largest examples of having a mass number of followers all being trained to be prophets. So yeah, you can train someone to do that. Samuel was not being trained to do so. That was not part of Eli's job. His job was to make sure Samuel served God in the temple, not trained to be a prophet. So as we discussed earlier, is it reasonable for Samuel or for Eli to expect God would now use Samuel as a prophet?
No.
Completely out of the blue. It was unexpected. Most likely, Eli would have expected either one of his children or grandchildren to be prophet, because Eli was a prophet. Not saying his sons were good people. We're not discussing that. His grandchildren, we don't know much about them. But to God to select Samuel, this was something he may not have expected. Now, how quickly do you think Eli caught on that something was going on here? I'll give you a hint in Eli's second response. By the second time, actually, Eli started to suspect. The first time he says to the boy, actually his phrase is, I did not call. Go back and lie down. But the second time, when you actually God says, Samuel, he comes over, of course, here I am, you called me. Eli's response is, I did not call my son. Go back and lie down. Note the additional phrase, my son.
Mm-hmm.
It is respectful. It's respectful of Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
Say, I didn't call you. Go back and lie down. It's a change in Eli's voice.
Yeah.
Something's different.
consideration.
And just in case I missed it the first time, okay, go back and lie down. We'll think about this. And of course, happens a third time. Eli knew. Ah, God's talking to you. This is what you're going to do. And so he realized God was talking. Says, go back, speak the Lord, your servant, speak the Lord, your servant is listening. Now, of course, Samuel doesn't use the word the Lord. He just says, speak, your servant is listening. It's been debated whether or not he forgot the word saying God, or because Samuel saw something different. I have written up here C. What was that?
I find it that the Lord appeared.
The third time.
Fourth time.
Let's see, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, so the fourth time. Yeah, the third time Eli figured it out. The fourth time, God appeared. Yes, Ellie.
What's the difference between a priest and a prophet?
Oh, glory, the whole world. Okay. Priest's function is to take a given individual or group of individuals, their physical screw-ups, their sins, their blessings, everything else they ever want to do and communicate with God with in that fashion, as far as, hey, God, thank you for blessing me. Here, have a cow. God, I did this horrible sin. Here, have a goat. That kind of thing. It's a sacrifice, functional thing. And to make sure that people stay physically clean and holy before God so they can go talk to him. The prophet...
Immediate,
thank you. The prophet's function is different. The prophet's function says, all right, yes, you can do all these sacrifices, but that's not the deal. Your heart and mind is not where God actually wants it to be. There's a different position to be in. Now, you can have your heart and mind in the right place and do everything evil, or corrupt, I should say, not evil, but corrupt. You can be a corrupt person physically, but your heart and mind is with God. Well, that's not good enough. You can also have somebody who does everything very clean and wonderful and perfect, but your heart and mind is not with God. That's not very good either. You need both. Hold on a minute. Yes.
That's basically, one of the ways to oversight is that a priest is uploading to God and a prophet is downloading to God.
That's fairly effective. Yes, Bill.
Prophet, he more or less stands in the gap and tells people where they're messed up. He doesn't say, something's coming. He said, this will happen if you don't.
If you don't. You're right. The prophets, one of the main functions, of course, is to break the barrier between God and man so they can interact and be with one another and actually talk. It's much the same way you can argue it. Well, prophet gets between the spirit of the law versus this priest is the requirements of the law. Now, you have to do both. You don't get away with just one or the other. But the prophet has to offset or have to add to what the priest can't add. So you can hit it. Go ahead.
Priest teaches the requirements of the law.
Right. And make sure that the person is able to fulfill them. It has to supply you with everything you need to do it. Okay. A prophet says, you know, supply your own needs. Your mind and your heart is not where it belongs to be, is where it's supposed to be. God needs it over here. Fix your actions, your deeds, your thoughts, and put it over here where it belongs. Then the priest can actually work with you. Because if I'm a priest and I'm dealing with you, if your heart and mind isn't there, all my instruction is worthless to you. It doesn't do anything.
So the prophet brings the person to the priest.
Which is really what actually happens. I mean, we look at their history throughout the prophets. What do they do? They're not talking to upright, righteous people, are they?
No, they're warning.
The vast majority are talking to corrupt people. Hey, you guys are so far down there. Get yourselves back where it belongs. Then we can start talking again. So right, when priests can end clean the priesthood up, which happens a few times too, they get faltered. Yes, Tammy.
That's why, you know, in our tradition, we talk about John the Baptist being the last prophet.
Right.
Because his duty as the Elijah to come, in a manner of speaking, is that he was the prophet, Yeshua is the priest. John the Baptist brought the people to the person that he was not fit to untie his shoes.
Right. Exactly, which is a great, great analogy. She's absolutely right on that. And that John the prophet essentially prepared the way. Hey, everybody, this is the direction to follow. Messiah says, okay, it's all leading to me. Now I can deal with you. Now I can work with you. Because he's supposed to be our high priest, right? He is the priest. That's the whole function. So, Messiah, was he a prophet?
Yes.
Yeah.
But he was more priest.
But his function was priest. Right. That was his functional title and goal. Right. Yes, of course, probably the Son of God. The guy can say whatever he wants and make it true. But yes, he was a prophet. But that was the point. His function was priesthood. John the Baptist, was he a priest?
No.
Well, in the family, but note, he actually really wasn't, his function, yeah, wasn't priestly. It was prophetic. Follow, look where it's going, look where your destination is, and follow it. So yeah, you can have one person who is one and the same.
Yeah.
Eli was an example of that. And possibly Ezekiel, I don't recall if he's a priest, high priest, but I could be wrong on that. So, we know at least Eli was supposed to be, until he got older and had children, was supposed to be that mix. Messiah is, by definition, that same mix. John the Baptist, by sheer lineage, is the same type of mix.
Yeah.
But they all did different, slightly different functions. So that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yep.
Thank you.
What would that be?
I'm sorry, say it again.
To prophesy?
I love the English definition.
Whatever, right?
No,
it's not
really
it's speaking forth.
Thank you.
Right, so it has different meanings.
To open up your mouth.
Speaking for God, whether it be things in the present or things in the future, even things in the past.
In the past, right. Okay, before I get too far off track here. So, yeah, Samuel wasn't originally being trained. Eli would not have necessarily initially expected him to be a prophet. It was kind of a, most likely a twist for Eli as well that same night. I'm sure he had a lot of things in his mind. He may not have been too focused on what was happening with Samuel and his growth and his schooling. But Samuel saw a vision, verse 10. Samuel didn't just hear God. He saw.
He stood.
Mm-hmm. No, Samuel didn't say.
The Lord came and stood.
Yeah, this man came and stood. Samuel didn't say, "Speak, my Lord," or "the Lord." Because Samuel may or may not have known that this was in fact God. He doesn't know. This is the first time God's ever appeared or spoken to the kid. He's a child, relatively speaking. I don't know his exact age. He's young. Yeah, but it doesn't say how old, because child by definition is 20 years or younger is child. Well, all right. How was he 19? Was he 7? We don't know. But he was, in modern day U.S., we think of children as usually, as I do, usually in their younger than teens age. Yes, Jeff.
Simple explanation is that the person's right in front of you. Why do you need to address them by name?
That is true. You could argue that. My argument is that it's possible that it was most likely the angel, and I don't know whether... Well, of course it was angel, because you can't... Well, it's a vision, so you could. It could have been God himself. We don't know. He's allowed to appear in visions, because you're not physically looking at him. So we don't really know. Well, the point is, he may not... Jeff may be right, simple. He just didn't address him by name, because he's standing right in front of him. Yeah, speak what you want. We don't know for sure, but he did. I just thought it interesting they left that part out.
You're kind of nervous. Is it the first time?
It is. It is very the first time.
You're tired.
Yeah, that's true. So he sees God. He hears God. And what does he hear?
First he hears his name.
Samuel, twice. Actually, I think it's a total of three or four times now. I think it's three times. He hears his name. And he hears a prophecy of God saying, hey, this is what's going to happen. And one of the words, one of the phrases that God, I like this phrase, it only shows up a few times in Scripture. I think it's quite fascinating. Let's see, it is verse 11. The Lord said to Samuel, behold, I am going to do such a thing in Israel that anyone who hears about it, both ears will ring. On that day I will fulfill for Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house beginning to destroy. I have told him that I am executing judgment against his house forever for the sin he committed. We're going to go through all this prophecy again. Both ears will ring. I think ears will ring up here, or tingle. The point is that it will catch your attention. This phrase occurs three times in Scripture. Once, the first time here, and the next two times verse the same scenario. But it actually happens another time as well. The criteria for this particular phrase has been, at least from our record, the destruction of the house of God. That's when God uses the phrase. Your ears will tingle. Your ears will ring. Because I'm going to destroy my home. I'm going to destroy the temple. Happens with the kings and with Jeremiah, when of course the kings come over, they wipe out the temple, destroy it, and everything like that. Happens at this point in time. actually, I guess the next chapter away from now, when the ark is taken and the temple is wiped out and everything else is destroyed. Yes, Jeff.
I guess in modern life, and there's so many things that can make our ears ring, it probably is even more significant at that time.
Which doesn't, no, but yeah, because, not all things happen make your ears ring.
Not too many occasions in life that would, you know, give you a ringing ears.
Yes. Yeah. Tammy.
Because like in Clark's analysis of this verse, he talks about it as being piercing and resounding.
Yes.
So less tingling is annoying.
Well, right. This is something. I think of ringing or tingling is that when somebody makes an extremely loud noise, a backfire of an engine or shoots a gun off next to your head, your ears
screech or a blackboard.
They ring. You can't hear anything because it's so profound and devastating that it hits you. This is something that's not supposed to happen. I mean, can imagine one of us going up and say, okay, yeah, you don't give a bulldozer over to level God's house. Remember, God, you don't level God's house. You're just an ordinary, simple little person. You can't take over God's home and destroy it.
No way.
It's not something which you think about. It couldn't happen. Well, he's pointing out, actually, you can't. God can. He can take out his own house, but nobody else gets to. And he does it. He does, of course, at this time. He does it again, of course, in the Kings with the ransack of the temple and destroys it all. Of course, you have the first and the second temple, all of which we're familiar with, and the rebuilding of it over and over again. Your ears will ring. It's something. It's a phrase that God doesn't use all the time. I think it's important to note when it happens. It's important.
Have you ever had a severe shock and there's a change in your blood pressure from the shock? Your ears ring.
I've never actually noticed that.
You actually have your ears. You go a little lightheaded.
A little lightheaded.
You hear it's I think probably caused by the your blood pressure.
Probably.
But you hear it ring.
Interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Not much of a physician. Yes, Anne.
The other is if you take too much aspirin, you know your ears will ring.
Oh.
It's
same thing. Aspirin versus the blood.
Octic.
Interesting. That's interesting. I was unaware of that. I didn't know there's a physiological explanation as well. So the first destruction of the temple, every time it's been used. So of course that tells Samuel. Well, Christ doesn't tell him because he's the first person it's been used for. He learns that that's what it means. The temple gets wiped out. That's what it means. And of course he's the one who learns it. Tough lesson to learn, be the first person to learn it, but at least he recorded it down for us to learn too, and to pay attention to. I gotta quickly go through this so I go back to verse 3. I hope you don't mind, I'm rushing up just a hair. So, as I mentioned before, Eli already knew, verse 17, that this was going to be a negative prophecy for Samuel, or a negative prophecy that God was going to be talking to him. That's hence Eli said, if you don't tell me everything, may it all be put upon you.
Yeah.
Good enough reason to say, okay. I'll tell you whatever you need to know. Because Samuel knew what it was. It was not something Samuel wanted to say, necessarily. We don't know for sure. I think Carrie's absolutely right. It stuck with him probably his whole entire life. Hence, he wrote it down for us to read. It obviously made an impression on him. Yes, Jeff.
You wonder if this is a bit of a foreshadowing of what happens with King Saul and David. Because
yes.
Basically, God had skipped over talking to Saul anymore.
And went right past him. Yes. God uses this formula a few times.
You have to wonder if Eli was starting to realize this. Wait a minute, he's not talking to me. He's talking to this kid.
Yes.
Or this young
kid. Which I think is, yeah, I'm sure you're absolutely right. God used this formula a few times. And the prophet that came to Eli either earlier that day or recently to it said the same thing. Why didn't God just talk to Eli directly and say it? Clearly Eli's eyes were too dim.
Yeah.
So his eyes were not functioning. God was not seeing what God was telling him anymore. For whatever reason, we kind of know the reason, but that's what was happening with his life. I apologize, I'm hair over time here. Let's go a little further. Verse 19, I like this statement just because it shows how much God loved Samuel. Samuel grew up, the Lord was with him. The Lord did not cast any of Samuel's words to the ground.
Wow.
Imagine being a prophet of God and God upholding what you say.
Pretty powerful.
Good.
Wow.
Awesome.
That is an amazing person to be a fearful of and God to be afraid of.
Yeah, which tells you that Samuel's heart was very closely entwined with God's.
Precisely. Precisely entwined, which is the whole reason why the lamp of God had not burned out yet, which I get to that. Yes.
Or afraid, more fearful to be that person.
Well, admittedly, that's true. It takes a unique kind of person to be this. But then again, Samuel was raised from the womb to be this.
So I don't
God
know.
Built
he
him.
Yielded to it.
Yeah,
to
God built him to be this.
He was on loan.
He was on loan for 50 years. All right. So okay. So let's go back a little bit. I'm sorry. What was that? Yes, the child was prayed for. God granted with Eli's blessing, of course. Which of course then the deal was, all right, 2 years old, he's mine. 50 years go by, he's yours. Oops, he's in the ground. That's the way it works. Okay. So let's go back. Lamp of God. We discussed that briefly. What is the lamp of God's spiritual purpose? Does anybody remember?
So God can see.
So God can see. All right. Remember the lamp has seven. Like we've heard the seven churches of God. We've heard this, the seven spirits. All those various things. They are God's eyes. Their function is to look and to look and observe and look what's going on at night. When everybody else isn't looking. That's important.
When they can't look.
When they can't look, he can see. Yes, Susan.
The eye is the lamp of the body.
Exactly.
The same thing.
It's the same thing. That's its function. Why is it made of almond blossoms? I've been studying this for Vicky. She asked me a week ago to study the almonds and almond tree. Okay, so I've been working on that. So it happens to work well here, so I'm using it. What is the purpose of God making the lamp, the menorah, look like an almond blossom?
Does it have to do with the Aaron's rod that budded?
That's part of it, but the lamp was designed and was being designed long before that. Yes.
The almond tree is the first to flower.
Yes.
And the last to fruit.
Yes, it is. Perfect. Perfect example. The almond tree is called the Purim almond. That's when it blooms. It blossoms at Purim in winter. The only fruiting tree that blossoms in winter and produces fruit in late summer, early fall. It's the only tree that does that. It's the earliest blooming tree. Why is the almond so important to God? Why would he do that?
It represents Israel.
It represents Israel, but something specific about him. I'm sorry, what was that?
It could
be
more than that.
Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot of things. We're getting it. We're going to just... Unfortunately, I only have like zero time left. I'm going to hit just a cursory explanation here. Yes, Jeff.
Well, the bloom is the sign that the fruit is coming.
It is a sign the fruit is coming. And what does the bloom do to the person who's watching?
Well, it beautifies you, lifts your spirits.
In the middle of winter.
Yeah.
In the middle of Purim.
It's very sweet smelling.
It is sweet smelling.
And it wears its blossom for a long
time. A very long
time.
It's a very long time. So God's eyes are always open. Yes.
Well, and winter is a kind of darkness.
It is a darkness.
I mean, from... Past,
you're right.
It's not a harvest time.
Right. Nothing. Well, not nothing grows. You know, some small plants grow, but there are a few things. But yes.
And then from Sukkot to the first place next year, you got nothing.
They got nothing. Yeah, like I said, there are little tiny plants, you know, winter plants. But for the most part, regarding trees and fruit, there isn't anything. Yes, Ellie.
Purim is the time of darkness.
Yes, it is the time of darkness. Yes, Anne.
It's the first blossoming tree, and
right.
It's the last fruit.
That's right.
Omega.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about that. That's a good point. It is alpha, type of alpha and omega. I didn't use that thought before. Okay. So we have all these various little bits and information about the almond, the blossom. Why would God use this on his menorah? Okay. Its eyes are always open. The almond oil from it. Its eyes are always open. So God's always looking. He's looking during... time when nobody else is looking. And what is he looking at?
You.
He's looking at Purim, which is you. He opens his eyes to look at good versus evil.
Oh, yeah.
Select the one who is evil and drop him aside. Select the one that is good, and that's when he selects. That's when he has chosen.
Good.
There's a reason this is inside the Ark of the Covenant. that Aaron's staff is this way and it's inside. He's not, God didn't do this haphazardly. Oh, well, hey, look what I did. Miracle. Okay, let's just throw it in the ark so nowhere else will store it. No, he did it for a reason. There's a purpose that's inside the ark. It's a selection process.
But he selected Aaron.
He selected Aaron. He selected Samuel because the lamp had not gone out yet. Yes, Jeff.
So in relation of what he's looking at there with the bread there on the other side, the bread of the 12 loaves of Israel, plus you've got altar of incense.
Always watching.
Always praying.
So it's got prayers and the bread.
And the bread, which is the produce, the growth of the land. Right. All before the lamp, or all right lamps always look for. Now, of course, the lamp only looks one direction.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
The menorah was written to draw to look forward.
Yeah, but it shines all over the place.
But the little blossoms were all pointed one way.
Right. Toward the front of it and the back of it.
Toward the bread.